This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex. And in this program, we'll visit with Kevin Danaher, a founder of Global Crossing and president of the Green Festival, plus a visit to the studio by young Joseph Boutelier, riding his unicycle across the Rocky Mountains to draw attention to climate change. But first, I need to ask one of the old hands about what to do while waiting for the crash. Richard Heinberg is next. There's a movie, What to Do in Denver When You're Dead. Now we know this carbon-based civilization is dead-ending itself in bankruptcy and climate chaos. What are we supposed to do while we wait for the collapse? It's time to call in a lifeline. Richard Heinberg has written about this future for decades in books like The Party's Over, The End of Growth, and his recent fracking book, Snake Oil. He's the senior fellow in residence at the Post Carbon Institute in California. Richard Heinberg, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's good to be with you again, Alex.
Well, hey, Richard, my food stash from 2009 is still in my basement unused. Everybody's predicting the crash, but it never seems to come. What if this crazy, deadly system just keeps eating up the earth and filling up the atmosphere for another 10 or 20 years?
Well, it is a remarkably resilient system on its own terms, given the challenges it's facing. And I have to admit, I'm one of those who thought that after the crash of 2008, we'd see events evolving in a different way than we actually have. What seems to have happened is that the world's governments, particularly the U.S., China, and the European Union, and the world's central banks, Federal Reserve and the central banks, again, of China and European Union, undertook extraordinary measures to keep the economy afloat, including deficit spending, huge stimulus packages, and quantitative easing, pumping literally trillions of dollars into the economy, creating the money out of nothing in order to lower interest rates and maintain consumer demand. And that's kept the wheels on the economy for the last few years. It's not a strategy that can continue indefinitely, but it has worked up to this point. And as you suggested in your introduction, the question is, for what purpose? You know, if we're just keeping this consumer economy on the rails in its current form without questioning its underlying premises, its reliance on fossil fuels, its depletion of renewable and non-renewable resources across the board, then we're just really making matters worse for ourselves as time goes on.
Yep, and we have the problem of leader burnout. The most glaring recent example is Michael C. Rupert, the 9/11 activist, founder of CollapseNet, host of the Lifeboat Hour radio show. What do you make of his suicide in April?
Well, you know, I personally don't read that much into it in terms of having broader implications for a movement or something like that. I knew Mike personally, and he was manic depressive. He had thoughts of suicide for years, and his closest friends were constantly trying to, keep him from that. So I think it's a personal tragedy, or if we even want to think of it that way, but it's not a bellwether event for a movement.
But I have to admit, there are times when I feel tired, when I feel beat. I mean, I'm not talking suicidal because I love life, but, you know, I have scientists who are warning about climate change on this radio program. I've got really bright people trying to bring the world's attention to absolutely critical threats. But frankly, my show never gets the million viewers of a single cat video. So people, you know, they're talking about celebrity scandals or errant billionaires, but a dying future just doesn't make the news or even dinner table conversation. How do you hold up?
Yeah, well, you know, those of us who are in it for the long haul, I think we really have to adopt an attitude of, you know, doing the right thing regardless of immediate results or gratification. I believe in the resiliency of the human species. I believe that we'll do the right thing once we have exhausted all other possibilities. You know, we're busy doing that right now, exhausting all the other possibilities. But if we don't do what we can. We who are aware of the challenges facing our species, if we don't do what we can to change direction and to develop more resilient alternatives in whether it's in economics or agriculture or energy systems, then the result is going to be that much worse. So even if we don't get nearly as much attention maybe as our aspirations deserve, you know, my attitude is if we're going down, I'm going down fighting.
You know, I've had scientists like Dr. Tim Garrett on Radio EcoShock explaining why this fossil economy has to crash to prevent an all-out climate catastrophe. We've had economists explain the whole banking systems based on fraud and corruption, and as you talked about, just money printing. But beyond the money printing, I'm wondering how this planet-killing machine keeps on going, and I kind of get the feeling that it's our own personal desires. You know, I'd feel better if I had a bigger truck or if I had that new dress. Somehow that's pulling this forward as well.
Well, yeah, the imperatives have been built into the system at this point. We don't have a consumer society just because we're all, you know, greedy animals. We have one because of economic choices that were made during the course of the 20th century. The problem then was overproduction. Cheap, abundant fossil fuels enabled us to produce consumer products faster than people could otherwise soak them up. So we created advertising, we created consumer credit as ways of stoking demand in order to keep the economy from collapsing as it did in the Great Depression in the 1930s due to, you know, insufficient demand. So, you know, we have this with this locomotive on the rails that has to go faster and faster all the time. We have to grow the economy constantly just to keep from crashing. It's an insane situation, and it's, again, it's not just the fact that, you know, we all want to have more stuff. Yes, it's true the Chinese want to have, you know, more stuff. People in less industrialized parts of the world want to have more of a consumer lifestyle. But it's not just individual and personal wants, it's the system itself.
I think this needs some analysis, some research. Maybe it could be the topic of your new book, like how this system manages to paint over such big cracks to extend and pretend. Have you read some authors or seen films that explain that?
Well, I've written on it quite a lot, actually, especially over the last few months. Because it, you know, it is an amazing spectacle to see this thing that has so many, by this thing I mean industrial civilization, that has so many inherent internal contradictions that's still able to maintain itself. But, you know, we're looking at it from close up. To us, an extra 5 years, or 6 years, which is what we've had since 2008, seems like a big deal. But in the longer term historic perspective, you know, a century is not that much. And what we're seeing, I think, is the inevitable wind down of a brief historic era, the era of fossil fuel industrialism. And that wind down is going to take a while. It's not going to happen overnight. We're already in the early stages of it, but it's going to continue for certainly the remainder of our lifetimes.
And last year you published the book Snake Oil about this fracking so-called miracle. Has fracking propped up this fossil economy for another decade?
Well, yeah, up to a point. It's kept the worst impacts of peak oil at bay because U.S. oil production has increased by about 3.5 million barrels a day as a result of fracking. That's basically the only real source of growth in world oil. It's not much, you know, it's less growth than we would have ordinarily seen in previous years, but it's been just enough to keep the wheels from coming off the bus. That's not going to continue much longer, however, because the resources, the tight oil in North Dakota and South Texas that the fracking boom relies on, these are low-quality resources, and while the geographic areas where the stuff is produced are fairly large, it's really only the core areas, the small sweet spots, if you will, a few counties in each of these states where production is profitable, really, at current market prices. So, you know, as the sweet spots are, of course, the next couple of years, We're going to see turnaround in production in both the Eagle Ford and the Bakken. And Americans will be asking, what happened to those decades of cheap oil we were promised? And we'll be right back where we were a few years ago when we were seeing oil prices soaring up to $150 a barrel.
Well, again, turning to coal, in your book Blackout, you showed the fallacy of humans believing we have another 250 years worth of coal left to burn. We're doomed if we did burn it. But coal mines are closing in my region in British Columbia, not because they're out of the stuff, but because there's such a glut of coal that prices are too low to produce it. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, two things are happening. First of all, in the natural gas sector, fracking has led to overproduction. And it takes a minute to explain that. What happened was the companies that were spearheading the new technology, mostly smaller companies, went out and bought up millions of acres in land. Well, they didn't buy the land. They leased the land for drilling. And having leased it, then they had to drill, because that's in every oil or gas lease contract. The company has to drill in order to keep the lease active. So they drilled and ended up overproducing natural gas, driving the price down below the cost of production. And with natural gas so cheap, the electric utilities industries across North America have shifted from burning coal to burning natural gas. Not entirely, of course, but to a very large extent. That's dramatically reduced the domestic demand for coal. And so U.S. coal miners are looking for, mining companies are looking for ways to export coal to Asia mostly in order to raise prices and stay in business. And the irony of this is that, as I explained in Blackout, U.S. coal resources and reserves have been very largely overestimated. And it's, once again, the story of the low-hanging fruit. It's not as though we're running out of coal, but we've mined the cheap, easy, high-quality stuff first. And so the costs of mining are increasing as the price of coal is declining. So this is a toxic situation for the industry itself. I suppose you could say it's a good thing from a climate standpoint, but if you're a coal miner or executive in a coal mining company, these are not happy times.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with Richard Heinberg about the awful revival of the fossil fuel economy, or is it? So, Richard, I'd really like to turn a little bit to geopolitics, and they're very seldom separated from the energy picture, as you and I know. We're hearing the drumbeats for a divided world again with U.S. and Europe versus Russia and China. I'm wondering if it's a sign of desperation, some sort of need to distract the population from these dead-end jobs or a dead-end civilization, or is it a military bailout? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, I think it's a complicated situation. There are ideologues in Washington, the so-called neocons, who are, you know, sort of embedded in the structure of the State Department and Defense Department at this point, regardless of whether it's a Democratic or Republican administration. And they've been on a regime change kick for over a decade now, since Afghanistan and Iraq, and, you know, just going after country after country. And I think with Ukraine, by fomenting a putsch there, they sort of bit off more than they could chew, because, of course, that's right in Russia's backyard. So you could explain what's going on now with heightened geopolitical attention just in those terms. But, of course, there's more than that. Why is Ukraine important? Well, of course, it's a transit point for natural gas from Russia to Europe, and that's a big sticking point. Now, of course, the press has been full of articles saying that the U.S. could and should undermine Russia's key playing card, which is its abundance of oil and gas and its status as one of the world's foremost oil and gas exporters. The U.S. could undermine that by exporting oil and gas itself to Europe and displace Russia in that regard. Of course, that's nonsense. The U.S. is still a major oil importer and also still a natural gas importer. We imported last year 11% of the natural gas we use. And the fracking boom, as I explained earlier, is basically a house of cards. It's not, doesn't have legs for decades, more like another couple of years. So basically we have nothing to export. So all of this is a bit strange to see right now, with U.S. and Europe lining up on one side, Russia, China, and a few other countries on the other. One hopes this is not the build-up to another major conflict as we saw in the 20th century.
There have been some hints that maybe some mega energy companies are hot to do fracking in the Ukraine. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, there are mega energy companies that were hot to do fracking in Poland, and they've pretty much all pulled out because the reality is fracking is expensive. It's difficult. It requires a high level of technology, and it requires good resources. And I haven't seen any geological data that would convince me at this point that the resources in Ukraine are any better than what was being touted in Poland just a couple of years ago. So, yeah, maybe there's something there, but I can't imagine that this whole conflict is simply a result of that.
I want to take just a minute, Richard Heinberg, to tell listeners about another piece of news hardly anyone will hear, and that is that Western energy companies are in bed with Vladimir Putin. BP owns part of one of the world's biggest energy companies, the Russian firm Rosneft, and ExxonMobil has a giant play with Rosneft to do exploratory drilling in the Arctic Sea north of Siberia. That first drilling will cost more than $500 million for a reserve estimated at over $9 billion, but who knows how realistic that is. And now the CEO of Rosneft is banned from traveling to the U.S. The American energy companies might get caught up in the boycotts. Everything's so interconnected with globalization. I can't help but think, Richard, that this so-called economic war will blow back or could blow back into a nasty fall for the world economy, including the United States. What are your thoughts?
Right. Yeah. Well, you did a very good job of setting forth all the factors there. Yeah, if the U.S. decides to push really hard on Putin, his wild card is these mutual exploration deals with Exxon and other Western companies. If he pulls the plug on those, that would have dramatic impact, especially for Exxon. Exxon really has the most at stake of any of the companies right now. And that would have some blowback effect on the U.S. economy. But you can imagine that the executives of Exxon are, you know, on the phone to their friends in the State Department right now trying to talk some sense into folks.
I thought they owned the State Department, a subsidiary of ExxonMobil. You know, the bright side of this could be, though, that nobody should be drilling in the Arctic anyway. There is no way to clean up spills there, like the BP spill in the Gulf of Mexico. That's what Greenpeace has been telling us all about, and the extra fossil fuels will kill off the planet anyway. Where are you on this Arctic drilling idea?
Well, it's a terrible idea, both from an environmental standpoint. There's no worse place in the world, except for perhaps the Antarctic region, but certainly the Arctic is a very fragile region. It's being devastated by climate change already anyway, and then to piggyback on that with very risky drilling. So it's very problematic from an environmental perspective, but also from an economic perspective. Like Shell has already pulled out of just about all of its Arctic projects because the costs are just too high. The oil companies need much higher oil prices to justify this kind of project. They need oil prices in the range of $140 to $150 a barrel. And until we get there, these are really money-losing propositions. So if they're proceeding, you can only assume that it's on the basis of the assumption that world oil prices are going up, and going up very substantially. If that's a bad bet, then these projects will be canceled.
Well, either way we lose. If oil prices go up like that, you've been one of the first people showing our economy would just bump and crash.
That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back closer to home for the home food budget. Food prices. California, your state, the whole state's now declared officially in drought. The Texas cattle industry sold out last year. Herds are down due to their drought. Anybody can see food prices are going up and up. What happens there? What do you see happening with food prices?
Well, you know, we're told that we're in an economic recovery, but in fact, for most people, incomes are flat to declining. For most Americans, incomes are flat to declining. So when food prices go up and fuel prices go up, gasoline prices go up, as they're doing right now across most of the U.S., it means, in effect, you know, even though GDP is up, the economic reality is dire and dismal for most people. And high food prices are a pretty good predictor of social unrest and conflict. That's certainly true in poor countries like Egypt. But it's also true in even wealthier countries like the U.S. and Canada. If incomes are flat or falling, but food prices are going up, people get restive, and politicians don't like that. So one has to wonder if, what are the plans? Frankly, I've thought for some years now that the massive efforts underway in the U.S. to militarize police departments and to universalize surveillance, as with the NSA, but also in other forms, must have to do with some awareness of long-range trends. And the trend we're talking about is a perfect example of this. If, in fact, we're headed toward higher food prices and even food scarcity, then we're also headed for more social unrest. And rather than looking for ways to reduce the ecological pressure by reducing population growth, making food production more environmentally sustainable, and so on, I think our leaders are furtively resorting to maybe the easy, cheap, and dirty solution, which is basically social repression.
Yes, I always thought when I watched the men kicking in the doorways in Iraq that you're training people to fight inside the city, and it could easily be our doorways that are being kicked in. But that's a dark subject that I don't want to go into right now, because I see a brighter side to this food problem, and that could be that more people will go into urban farming, the sort of back-to-the-land movement as well, kitchen gardens. There's some positive things that come out of these pressures. Now, you've been a stalwart at the Post-Carbon Institute. What is the Institute doing when it comes to envisioning a post-carbon world?
Well, the main thing we're doing is trying to keep people updated on a daily basis of what's happening, both in the energy world and the environmental world, but also in the world of resilience building. So our website, resilience.org, is just a wealth of information about what's going on with transition towns and other resilience building activities, local food movements, local currencies, and so on. And you can pretty much bet that anything that's being written that's relevant to those subjects is going to appear on today's front page of resilience.org.
Yes, you know, I just looked into yesterday a whole raft of stories about people doing backyard farming, and I'm going to do a whole show on it because it's growing, and a wonderful picture popped up on my Facebook page of gardens in Geneva where there just are no lawns. The whole thing is just back-to-back gardens for people. So have you seen some things in California that are worth spreading around the world? Any ideas to pass on from your general area?
Well, you know, this, in a way, this is old news. I mean, my wife and I have been doing this for a couple of decades now, and you know, I'm looking out the window into my backyard from my home office and looking at our vegetable garden and our chickens, and my wife's out there right now, you know, planting the summer garden. This is a huge trend. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is saying local food is the biggest trend in farming today. Farmers markets are taking off all over the place. You know, people see the writing on the wall. Of course, as climate change happens and as much of the West descends into drought, it makes it difficult to do what we're doing. You know, if prices of water are up and if local municipalities are forced to, you know, more or less ration water for like home gardening, it makes it really tough to, you know, do the right thing. But the incentive is certainly going to be there. What's going on in the Central Valley of California right now is, I don't think enough people are paying attention, because this is the most productive agricultural area for the U.S. in terms of vegetables, fruits, and nuts. And a lot of farmers there are just giving up right now because they don't have the water allotments to make it sensible to plant the summer's crop.
I've heard even Los Angeles may be getting some water restrictions, so we get back to the old question of, do we give it to agriculture, which uses most of the water and loses too much of it, or do we give it to the cities where the voters are, and we know which way that's going to go.
Right, yeah. And, you know, more of us should be listening to the permaculturalists who for a long time been saying, look, you know, we need to make our food system far more resource efficient. Permaculture, although it doesn't advertise itself this way, it advertises itself as saving labor, making gardening as, you know, the lazy person's garden. But the reality is, if more of our food were grown by way of permaculture, we would be investing a lot more labor into food production than is currently the case, because right now so much of it's done by machines. But permaculture is a way of reducing resource inputs, and that includes water, but also includes fossil fuels. It's the general direction in which we need to be going. Whether we call it permaculture or ecological farming, or it doesn't matter what we call it. But our food system has to transition in this general direction. And the writing is on the proverbial wall with this drought in the West.
So if a community comes to you, and I know they do, how would you advise, say, a small town or even a mid-sized city to proceed towards a sustainable future? That's a huge question, I know, but what sorts of things would you tell them?
Well, first, look at your food system and think of it as a system. So, you know, where is your food currently coming from? What food is currently being produced in the vicinity? What are the levers? Like, where does the school system buy its food for school lunches? And how can this be localized? How can we promote more local production for local consumption? Find out where the levers are and start making use of them. Identify what's already going on that's really good. Maybe there's already a farmer's market, and start promoting it. Make it easier for local citizens to have chickens in their backyards or to garden on their front yards rather than growing lawns. There are all sorts of things that municipalities can do, and a lot of them are starting to do these things.
And I think they'd have to look at their energy patterns, too. I mean, how are we going to keep going as a community when gasoline does cost over $2 a gallon or $4 a gallon? And how can we produce more of our own local energy here that's really resilient? Can we do that?
Right. Something that we've done here in Sonoma County over the last couple of years is we've created a community power agency, Sonoma Clean Power. And it enables people to opt out of the corporate utility and to buy electricity that is either 100% renewable or more renewable than the alternative. So that's something local regions can do. Then transportation is something you mentioned, but it's a huge one because still counties and cities and states across the U.S. and provinces in Canada still investing enormous amounts of money in building new roads and widening roads. This is like taking, you might as well take the money and put it in the middle of the road and set fire to it for all the good it will do us 10 or 20 years from now. We need a completely different view of our transportation future. And that future is not a world of cars and trucks. It's a world of bicycles and people walking and public transportation if we're smart enough to build it now.
Cars make really good planters. I've seen a couple in Vancouver that were flourishing with flowers and food once you hack that roof off and do a little planting in them. Well, look, what about our culture, too? I know you play a mean violin and you do public speaking, like to real people instead of just TEDx on YouTube. What does a sustainable planet need in the way of culture to keep our hearts and minds stable in unstable times?
Right. Well, local culture, I think, is an overlooked aspect of localism because it's, you know, we need to be investing more in culture at a time when the tendency is going to be to invest less. You know, in hard economic times, as food gets more expensive, energy and transportation get more expensive, and people's incomes are diminishing or staying constant, the first thing that people want to write off is investments in local music, local art, and it doesn't have to be that way. We need to be nurturing our local arts and participating in them, you know, making art not so much of an observer, but more a participant activity, learning how to play an instrument, getting together with friends and whatever you enjoy doing, whether it's needlecraft or whatever element of our arts and crafts, because this is how we create a satisfying human society. It's not a spectator sport. It's entirely built by owner built, you know. When we look at what actually makes people happy, it's not having lots of consumer products. It's what we actually do together and having a beautiful environment, creating beauty, whether through sound or dance or visually and gardens or whatever. That's what makes life worthwhile. So as times get tough, you know, what we really should be doing is making our world more beautiful.
I think you've hit a high point there. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You've been listening to one of the pioneers in the post-carbon world to come. Richard Heidenberg appears in major publications and media. His books are all still essential, in my opinion. Try the Party's Over, Peak Everything, recently Snake Oil. And you can find Richard as the senior fellow in residence at the Post-Carbon Institute. That's at postcarbon.org. Follow his ongoing newsletter or just visit richardheinberg.com. Richard, thank you so much for joining us here on Radio EcoShock.
It's always a pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. In the world of activism, we tend to split into two branches. One attacks the existing human system, things like globalization, the World Bank, and social inequality. The other protests our destruction of nature while struggling to create a pathway to a survivable future. Our guest is one of those rare souls who marries both together. Dr. Kevin Danaher is the author, co-author, and editor of 11 books. Some expose the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the cabal of the 1%. Others lay out the grassroots of a greener world. Kevin co-founded the Global Exchange, long dedicated to social justice, but he also founded and continues to share leadership of green festivals in major American cities, including Los Angeles and New York, and coming up, Washington, D.C., at the end of May 2014. He's an activist in San Francisco as well, where he founded Friends of the SF Environment. Kevin's Ph.D. from the University of California is in sociology. Kevin Danaher, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks for having me on, Alex. I appreciate it.
I'll be honest, we couldn't cover the things you've done and do in a day, much less the time we have, but why don't we start with this? Many of us desperately hope we can avert a climate disruption in our lifetimes, and you've talked about this, asking if humanity can save itself, so let's go for the big one right off the bat. Can we?
Well, yes, definitely. Our approach is we consider ourselves solutionaries, and we encourage people to think of themselves as solutionaries. Solutionaries look at a problem and see the solution within the problem. So, for example, the September issue of National Geographic has a cover story about ocean levels. And it shows that if all the ice on the planet melts, which it does seem to be doing, it raises ocean levels over 200 feet. So you think about Vancouver and San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York and Havana and Shanghai, all these major cities are right on the ocean or on a river that feeds into the ocean. So what we look at is things like eco-levees. Eco-levees would be large mounds of rammed earth with saltwater-tolerant plants on the ocean side, bike trails, fruit trees, park benches on top like a long park, and terraced urban agriculture on the inland side. And, you know, the problem is when I raise this with adults, most of the adults say, oh, but that's off in the future. We're talking about our grandchildren or maybe the children of our grandchildren. And we don't want to be bad ancestors. We think of ancestors as people that came before us, but we're ancestors too, and we need to be good ancestors. So all of these problems, in fact, create opportunities for green enterprise, for a new kind of economic model that is in tune with Mother Nature and makes better profits by saving the environment than by destroying it. That's a different economic model.
Well, there has been a divide between economic activists talking about things like the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank and environmentalism. What do you tell Greens about the need to deal with things like globalization and big financial institutions?
Well, it's very similar to when the discussion of solar energy or wind energy comes up. I always raise the issue, are we talking about massive, concentrated solar and wind, or are we talking about small distributed renewables? Because if it's huge, that means either big government or big corporations. And that's anti-democratic in its very structure. Those institutions are hierarchies. They have all sorts of multiple levels of decision making where it's really hard for people to participate or to penetrate and even understand. I have a PhD in sociology. I wrote a dissertation on U.S. foreign policy. I know about bureaucracy. When it's small and local and controlled by local communities, there's much greater potential for democratic participation. When it's huge and requires a lot of money and it's all concentrated in one place, that's problematic, as we've seen in so many, nuclear power, fracking, all these other areas. So what we're trying to do with the Green Festival is to show the public, we get tens of thousands of people attend, that the solutions exist already. It's not something off in the future. It's just that they tend to be smaller companies. They need capital. They're not huge. They're growing, and they have the technology, the techniques, the materials. It's just they need some capital investment, and that's what we're hoping to do with this consumer event, is get the public in there, get them supporting these companies, because these companies have the solutions.
Well, I've got lots of questions for you about the Green Festival, and that's going to be one of our focus of our talk here today. But I do want to ask you, I mean, Princeton just released a study saying America is an oligarchy, not a democracy. Is democracy dead, Kevin?
No, I don't think democracy is dead. We just need to get back to the original definition. It comes from two Greek roots, demos, meaning people, and kratos, meaning rule. People rule. Here in the United States, we're a democratic republic, and republic comes from two Latin roots, res meaning thing and publica meaning of the people. A thing of the people where the people rule. Well, do the people rule? No, money rules. So we do have an oligarchy, but we can see that, we can document it. I'm pushing the idea of having members of Congress wear uniforms, because police, firefighters, every public servant wears a uniform. If Congress wore uniforms, they could look like NASCAR jumpsuits with the decals of the corporate donors in relative size to the amount of money they get, and that would bring transparency to government. Picture a hometown meeting where the member of Congress or your parliament comes home for a meeting in the community, and there's about six or seven life-size cardboard cutouts out in front with their uniform on. The media would eat that up. It would be on the front page of every newspaper and every TV show. So we have the ability, if we mobilize, if we educate and mobilize the public, to take back the concept of people rule. That's what we've lost.
Right. I just love this idea, the Koch brothers symbol on the outside of the politician instead of on the inside of the politician. Now, do you expect this infinite growth system has to crash before we can get the changes that we need for, say, a green economy, or can we make it somehow?
Well, I think it's actually crashing. Every biological system on the face of this planet is in a state of collapse. Topsoil erosion. In the U.S., we lose between 2 billion and 8 billion tons of topsoil a year. Ocean levels rising, rainforest being cut down. CO2 levels haven't been this high in over 3 million years. Temperature going up, it's changing agriculture, bugs are spreading to places where they didn't go before. So the system is collapsing, whether you measure it in those environmental criteria or if you look at inequality, the richest 1% of American families own more wealth than the poorest 90%. You can't have real democracy or development, democratic development, with that kind of inequality. So the system is sort of in the middle of a crash, but we're in the middle of a transition. There's a new system being developed that's based on a triple bottom line. Instead of the single bottom line of just profit, it's social justice, the equity question, environmental restoration, not just conservation, because we've destroyed so much we have to restore it, and financial sustainability, what's usually called profit. I like to call it financial sustainability. Global Exchange, where I work, is a nonprofit, but we use enterprise. We have fair trade stores. We do reality tours. We publish books. We do events like the Green Festival. And that's enterprise, but it's not enterprise for me to become a gazillionaire. It's enterprise to change the world and to save humanity from self-destruction.
So for those who have never been, what is a Green Festival? What can we expect there?
Well, if you came to a green festival in New York, Chicago, D.C., San Francisco, Los Angeles, what you would see is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of solar energy companies and wind energy companies and eco-flooring companies and all sorts of food companies that are mixing the best organic ingredients based on the science of what's good for your body. People don't realize that eating sugar is really bad for you, and sugar is in so much of what we eat and all the junk food and McDonald's and all that kind of stuff. So we're exposing people to the next economy. The next economy is going to be a green economy. And it's not just consumerism, because we have speakers, we have films, we have do-it-yourself, where we show people, if you want to put solar panels on your house, here's how you do it. If you want to grow vegetables in your backyard, here's the easiest way to do it. So it's empowering people, equipping them to make a transition to the next system. You can either live in the world as it is, which is a mess, or the world as it could be, which is this green world. And once people make that realization that they can jump to that new system and live their life in a more sustainable way, it unleashes a lot of spiritual energy, and people get fired up with these new ideas and new technologies. So I think we're in transition. We're actually experiencing the first ever global revolution. Every revolution until now was a national revolution, where the revolutionary sought to gain power in the capital city to run that country differently. This is a global values revolution, where we're saying, instead of having money values rule over the life cycle, we need to have life values rule over the money cycle. And that's a fire alarm going off in the building.
Are you planning on evacuating right now?
No, they announced that they were going to do a test. Sorry.
Okay, well, there's a fire alarm going off in the world building right now, and that's about climate change and about a lot of issues that we have. So, look, Kevin, some of our listeners I know will have doubts about things like the Green Festival. They consider them another form of consumption, another platform to advance consumption. How do you handle that objection?
Well, what we've talked to people about is, look, everybody buys stuff. You buy toilet paper and shoes and shirts and carpet and bedding and mattresses and siding for your house and paint and all this other stuff. So you can either buy the clean, green stuff that's not going to hurt other people and other living things, or you can continue buying this garbage that's destroying us. We in the United States are the most wasteful people on the planet. We're less than 5% of the world's population, consuming about 25% of the world's resources and putting out a little more than 25% of the world's pollutants. We've got to change. We have a special responsibility to the rest of the world. We have 865 military bases outside of our country. We have 240 military golf courses that I'm paying for with my taxes. If people would wake up to these facts and start acting accordingly, we'd get a different kind of government. We wouldn't have these Republicans in Congress who say they don't believe in climate change, like it's Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny or something like that. It's not about believing. It's called science. It's been proven. Thousands of PhD glaciologists, oceanographers, etc., are saying, look, we can't keep going the way we're going. So we're approaching that fork in the road, and as Yogi Berra said, when you come to the fork in the road, take it, especially if you want to eat. I think we're at a really great point in history where we get a chance to save our species from self-destruction. No other species has that ability to foresee its own demise and then to take corrective action to make sure that that does not happen.
It's kind of a good news, bad news situation. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with one of America's notable environmental and social activists, Kevin Danaher. On May 31st, you'll be giving a keynote talk at the Green Festival in Washington, D.C. What will you be talking about?
Well, I'm going to be talking about these very things, and I'll be also letting people know that we've got a bunch of new aspects. Green Festival's been around for 13 years now. We've done 8 different cities across the U.S., and we're introducing a Green Festival Brand Award to celebrate the companies and brands that are transforming the way we live. We're having a Super Green Consumer Prize for, like, the best consumer in the show. And we're also having a Green Festival Community Award that goes to a local nonprofit organization, $5,000, for local nonprofit organization that's doing the best work locally. So lots of good things going on, and, you know, we've been a leader. This is the largest and longest lasting green economy show in the United States. And actually, my project is to try and take it into a real estate model. You go to any city in the United States and you say, where's the store where I can see all the green products in one place? It doesn't exist yet, and that's way overdue. So what we're trying to do first in San Francisco and then roll it out to other cities is have a building that would have all of these local green fair trade and salvage companies, companies that are doing upcycling, taking stuff out of the waste stream like TerraCycle in New Jersey, and making good products out of what otherwise would have gone to the landfill. Those three categories, green, fair trade certified, and salvage companies, they want you to know the story of where their product came from and what was the impact socially and environmentally. The stuff that's dependent on pollution and sweatshops in China, they want to hide the GMOs. They're fighting, the companies like Monsanto, they're fighting having GMO labeling. Hey, if it's such great technology, you should be bragging about it and want it on your label. No, they don't, because they know that people are wary about this stuff. So the transparency economy is coming, and it's going to be here soon.
Well, I'd like to return just for a second to your other persona, the veteran social justice advocate and corporate critic. I worry, have corporations totally taken over now?
Well, if you look at, I know the United States best, and I think maybe Canada isn't quite as bad off as the United States, but they took over the healthcare system. We have a massive problem with our healthcare system being unaffordable for most people. They took over the food system. They're polluting everybody's bodies with this horrible food you shouldn't eat. They took over the agriculture system. It's all about mining the soil and dumping chemicals on it to goose the soil to produce more soy, wheat, corn, you know, these products that are mostly used to feed animals, actually. And they've taken over the public media, the public airwaves, which we are the landlord. We, the people, are the landlord. They're the tenant. They don't pay us any rent. They get to use the public airwaves for free and pollute our minds with all this commercial advertising. And now they've taken over the government. And I don't know if you've seen these recent U.S. Supreme Court rulings where they've taken the cap off of any kind of restriction on donations by rich people to politicians. So that means that the rich have access, and I've experienced this myself. One of my major donors, I was complaining about this one time, and he said, oh, well, just call the senator up. And I said, he's not going to talk to me on the phone. And he said, sure, watch. And he calls up, and as soon as they hear his name, because he can pop a $60,000 check real easily, he gets the senator on the phone. But the average citizen is not going to be able to have access to a member of Congress. So we've got a very skewed system here, and we need to find ways to take it back. And what I'm pushing is the idea of separation of corporations and the state. The United States, our political system was founded on the principle of separation of church and state. And that protects religion from government control, and it protects government from being taken over by religion. There's a deeper principle underneath that, and that is that no one institution, in this case religion, should take over government, but no one institution, corporations, should take over government either. So we should have separation of corporations and the state. And that would be no campaign financing, no revolving door of employment where Dick Cheney is in government, goes into corporation, goes back to government, goes back to corporation. And what these guys do is they're selling to the corporation their contacts inside the government. And there's a long list of corruption charges that have eventually been brought against people who did this kind of using their connections to fatten their own bank account. And it's the definition of corruption. And actually, there are federal statutes making this illegal. If they were enforced, all members of Congress would be in jail, because they say anything of value given with the intent to influence policy is a corruption crime. Well, that goes on all the time. I used to live in Washington. You see it going on in the halls of Congress all the time. So this is about mobilizing the citizenry, and whether it's, you know, the Occupy movement on the left or the Tea Party people on the right, they're all saying, let's get control of government back.
All right, we're just about at the end of our time, but I would like you, if you could, tell us about the Green Guardians.
Yeah, the Green Guardians is a youth group that we've started in San Francisco, and we've started with urban agriculture at Mission High School. It's a high school right near my office. I started doing volunteer work there. It's an amazing high school, public high school. Principal is just this incredible visionary leader. There's 60 nonprofit groups, all sorts of, you know, teen pregnancy and urban agriculture, and there's a bike shop where if the kids build their bikes, they get to keep the bike. And what we're trying to do is create a model that could be scaled out to other schools and other communities where we teach young people these urban survival skills of urban agriculture and tree planting and water conservation and recycling and composting, because most people live in cities now. We're an urban species. So we have to solve this challenge of sustainability in the urban environment. And you see it going on sort of piecemeal in different places, but a lot of times it's called, you know, the Green School Program or something like that, whereas Green Guardians is something they can identify with. They have T-shirts, you know, and they can say to other kids, hey, you know, we're doing this sidewalk, we're tearing out this cement, and we're putting in gardens. Every time we're out working in our sidewalk gardens, when people walk by, they comment, oh, it's so much better than that cement, that ugly cement. The city benefits, and the city gave us the money to take out the cement in the sidewalks because they want to get rainwater down into the aquifers and recharge the springs, because nature gives us millions of gallons of rainwater free, and we treat it as waste and put it in the sewers and run it through a treatment plant. It's ridiculous. We need to get it in the ground. So things like that really charge kids up. And my kids, when you give them a chance between being in a high school classroom, sitting at a desk, or being outside digging in the dirt, they'll take outside almost every time.
As we part company, Kevin, can you give us the details of what's coming up for the Green Festival and the websites or social media spots where people can tune in?
Sure. It's greenfestivals.org. Very simple. Greenfestivals with an S, .org. And there they can see our New York show, our D.C. show, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, the companies, the speakers, the kinds of awards we give out. And we're hoping that this will encourage people to not be despondent about the future. We can change this, but we have to get motivated. We have to get off our butts, turn off the TV, and get out there and be activists. We remind people all the time that the center post of your washing machine that gets the dirt out, it's called an agitator. And we need to be agitators. The correct position of a democratic citizen's mouth is open and demanding action for change of our leaders. So, yes, it's a consumer event. Yes, it's a green economy event, but it's also an activist event where we're trying to empower people to change the world and save our species from self-destruction.
Dr. Kevin Danaher is many times an author, co-founder of many organizations, including Global Exchange and America's Green Festivals. You can find links to his upcoming talk, The Green Festivals, and more in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith saying, Kevin, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Climate change hangs over the next generation even more. What can one person do? Joseph Boutillier has set off on a cross-Canada trip, well, most of Canada, to raise public awareness. His vehicle is just a single wheel, a unicycle. Joseph, welcome to Radio EcoShock right here in the studio.
Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, tell us about your project, would you?
Yeah, absolutely. So pretty much as you said, it's a 5,000-kilometer trip from Victoria, B.C. to the nation's capital. I'm trying to raise awareness of climate issues and really bring climate change to the forefront of discussion before the upcoming 2015 federal election and make it a priority issue. That's my aim.
Right. Before we get more details on that trip, I am interested in what a younger generation thinks about climate change. First of all, how and when did you really become aware of the mega threat posed by climate disruption?
You know, I'm not sure if I was aware just of the severity of the crisis, but I first kind of became familiar with the term at the UN Children's Conference on the Environment that was hosted in Victoria when I was about 10, and that was 2000. You know, even when I heard about it then, it was sort of shocking to me that I hadn't heard about it before, that it was already recognized as a severe threat and it was already kind of happening unequivocally. And yet it wasn't another, you know, 10 years before it really became on the forefront of mainstream discussion with the Al Gore's film and everything else. So as time progressed, it just became more and more evident to me how urgent it was, but also how badly represented it was, you know, given the threat in the mainstream media.
So if we just keep on going, Joseph, the way we're going, what do you picture the future will look like?
Well, I mean, predictions are pretty grim. Of course, they range greatly, but I think, you know, we only have to look overseas to see, you know, what the severity will be like across the whole world. Of course, it will continue to get worse in nations where they're already struggling, but, you know, we're blessed to be relatively sheltered here and also have kind of the ability to adapt. But, you know, there's already thousands of lives being lost overseas from famine, from heat waves, from countries being entirely submerged gradually like the Maldives. And that's going to happen across the world. And, you know, we frankly are talking about the collapse of civilization, if not the human species within a century is the worst case scenario. And that's incredibly disturbing and especially so because we know what the solutions are, and I think turning the tide should be so tangible, and yet it just seems like there's not the impetus right now.
Yes, it's looking pretty grim, as you say. That's what scientists are telling me, and of course they're making world reports from all sorts of agencies are coming out and telling us that, and yet we seem to keep on going. Personally, you know, when I drive a vehicle to the gas station, I expect to buy gas. And yet I'm very critical of the oil companies. So we're all caught in this kind of paradox. What is it about you that you didn't just go ahead and get a job and keep driving around and living the way everybody else is living?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm not an eco-saint by any stretch of the imagination. I'm very much trapped in the same system as everyone else. And that's kind of why, I guess, unlike a lot of other young people, I still look to the system for change to some degree and believe that our government can facilitate a transition into renewable energies as well as individuals, of course. But I guess ultimately I feel like climate change is just something that demands our full attention. And this trip is the best way that I could think to do just that in my personal life and try and raise as much awareness as possible within a country that is really obstructing international progress for climate change. There's a huge opportunity in Canada, I think, to make our country kind of a world leader, and we're the exact opposite right now. So,
do you think that your journey can help spark other individuals who are concerned about this to figure out what they can do? I mean, everybody has a different gift. Not, I can't ride a unicycle. But there's probably something I can do. How do you see your trip in relationship to other people's dreams of what they can contribute?
Well, that's actually one of my favorite things about the trip so far is just talking to individuals, you know, folks who support me and billet me or, you know, give me a hot coffee, a roof over my head for a night, but also town councillors and mayors to see what's happening at the municipal level, but also just what individuals are doing. And it varies greatly. You know, there's people who very much look to their own lives and are eliminating, you know, plastics or just sort of reducing their consumerism in huge strides. And then there's people who are acting more externally and really working in their communities to develop, you know, food security and community gardens and renewable energy sources that are hooked up kind of to, you know, the solar grid, installing charging ports for electric vehicles. All of these relatively small, very tangible projects that really are representing the most dramatic shift for the better in Canada right now. It's all happening on the local level, and it's all happening because of passionate individuals who are making incredible personal sacrifice and commitment for this issue.
So how do people tune into your trip? Have you got a webpage going, a blog, or a Facebook? Tell us the addresses. Tell us how we get in touch with you.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's all at www.unityfortheclimate.ca. There's a lot of info there and links to Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, all the usual social media channels, all that good jazz.
And your target is to get to Ottawa, the capital of Canada. When do you think you might get there?
So my aim is to get there September 13th, which is sort of the weekend before the opening of fall session of Parliament. And it's generally, again, a time where there's a lot happening for, you know, in terms of the environment, with environmental rallies. It's about a week before Climate Fast begins as an annual week-long fast for climate issues. And yeah, hoping to kind of sweep some of the momentum that we have here in the West Coast, specifically around a lot of the pipelines being proposed and tar sands expansion, and really bring that to the national conversation in Ottawa at that time.
Right. So listeners in Canada, if you can track Joseph coming your way, be sure and hook him up with the people he needs to meet and maybe provide a couch or a bed for him that night. It would sure be a big help for him. Good luck on your trip. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Joseph Boutillier is an example of a young person who can't just let climate disruption sweep the earth and keep quiet about it. He's in the early stages of a journey across this big country to bring attention to climate change. Thanks again, Joseph.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are so out of time. Get links for this show at ecoshock.info. Visit our new SoundCloud page. Find us on Facebook. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for listening and caring about this world.